Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This is episode 546 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. If you're a first-time listener, we're happy you found us, but this episode is a bit different from the normal format. There are no co-hosts and no industry guests. That's because this week we are at the Sun and Fun International Fly-In and Expo. But we do have something special for you. Interviews from the Women Take Flight event at the New England Air Museum held Saturday, March 9th, 2019. This event was held in commemoration of Women's History Month and in conjunction with Women of Aviation Worldwide Week. Visitors of all ages came to celebrate women's contributions to aerospace history through a variety of hands-on activities, special events, and three guest lecturers. Those were Marianne Cannon, Vice President of Commercial Engine Programs at Pratt & Whitney, Christy Fleischman with Acrojet Aerospace Solutions, and Shasta Ways, Founder and President at Dreams Soar. In addition to the lectures, Women Take Flight offered visitors the opportunity to meet women pilots, engineers, and industry professionals who were set up at tables throughout the museum. We talked with some of them, and we also had a conversation with Debbie Reed, the executive director of the New England Air Museum. Well, let's start our conversation with Leah, a senior at a girls' high school participating in the year-long Sikorsky STEM Challenge with a project to modernize cockpit control mechanisms.
So I'm here with Leah. You're a student at a high school, a local high school?
Yeah, I'm a senior.
And you're involved in the Sikorsky STEM Challenge, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is our third year in the program.
And tell us a little bit about the program.
Mm-hmm. So the program, Sikorsky, initiates, they send out a challenge. It's a year-long project to a few schools around the state. And over the course of the year, we complete various modules pertaining to different aspects of the project. And we submit them to be graded by judges from Sikorsky. And eventually, we have a final presentation where we present our final projects to a panel of judges. And they pose a series of questions and evaluate us based on what we show them.
And what kind of a project are you working on for this year?
This year, we're actually modernizing the traditional cockpit control mechanisms. So we're taking the mechanical systems and instituting a computer-based fly-by-wire system instead.
Wow. So how did you learn how to do that?
It's definitely been a learning curve. Our first year in the project, we had no idea what we were doing, but over the course of the year, we kept at it. Just a lot of trial and error. We received a lot of feedback and help from our mentors from Sikorsky. And it's just breaking it down and taking it step by step has really helped us.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the mentorship and mm-hmm. if someone was from Sikorsky or some other professional was helping you to do this. So what kinds of things do they do that helps you complete the project?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, they really break down the project for us, and they give us a lot of resources and information to look at. But we also actually have a employee from Sikorsky who's responsible for communicating with us, and then we meet in person about every week or so. We're actually lucky. We love our mentor. Her name's Ashley, and she's actually a former alum at our high school. Ah. So she kind of gets it. So it's a lot of fun just being with her. And, like, she's very helpful, but we also have a lot of fun with her, which is nice.
So what's the timeline for the project? How far are you along in terms of this year's project?
Mm-hmm. We're pretty close to the end. It started in September. So right now we're on our fourth module out of five. So this module is kind of gathering everything we've done and presenting it and finalizing it and tweaking it. And then the next module will actually be the final presentation.
Wow, that's pretty exciting. Mm-hmm. That's pretty exciting. So what do you, are you a senior in high school now?
Yeah, I'm a senior.
So what happens next for you?
I'm going to Yale next fall, and I'm planning on majoring in engineering. I'm not exactly sure what area I'm going to major in, but I'm excited.
Yeah, great, great. You have a lot of time to decide. Mm-hmm. I know when I went to engineering school, also at a high school, I had no idea what kind of an engineer or what I was going to do. You don't know. It's an opportunity to discover, you know, what excites you and what you might get into.
Mm-hmm.
How about the others in the on the team here? How big is the team?
The team's about 30, so it's a really big group. So like it's really important, like the organization of it. So usually we split up into little sub teams with team leaders, and then all the team leaders talk to each other just to make sure everyone has a good idea of what's going on and everyone's stays in the know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And did I hear correctly? You're like the president of this team?
Yeah, I'm the president. Mm-hmm.
So how did that come about? Is that because you're the smartest?
I don't know about that, but I've just been really involved in the project since it first started my sophomore year, and then I was appointed an officer last year, and then I just care a lot about it, and I'm really passionate about it, so I think that's probably why I was appointed president this year.
Great. Well, congratulations on that.
Thank you.
So just one last thing. Tell me about what you want to accomplish here today at this event with all these kids that are here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's really cool because Laurelton Hall, my high school, it's an all-girls school. So there's always been like kind of like a sense of empowerment within our community. And no one's ever like scared to pursue STEM fields or like the engineering team. Like at other schools, that might be very like male dominated or just kind of intimidating for girls. But at our school, it like you don't even think twice about it. So kind of just like getting little kids and people of all ages actually just engaged and just showing some exciting things in the area so that they kind of develop a passion that will hopefully carry them through so that girls and boys will feel empowered enough to pursue these careers.
That's excellent. So did you know all along that you wanted to be an engineer, or was there something that happened or some person or something that influenced you to kind of, you know, be interested in engineering?
I mean, I've always kind of had an affinity towards math and science, but I didn't really know I wanted to be an engineer until about sophomore year in high school when I first started in this program. And just kind of, the firsthand experience really opened my eyes to see how big the engineering industry is and how many opportunities there are, especially for girls. And like my mentors who are here with me today are like my teachers. They were my physics and math teachers, and they really kind of empowered me, and I've just like loved having them as teachers, and they've really made the subjects exciting. So they've opened my eyes to how rewarding the field can be.
That's great. Well, thanks, Leah. Have a wonderful day.
Thanks so much.
And good luck with the challenge this year.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks.
We spoke with Marianne Cannon, Vice President of Commercial Engine Programs at Pratt & Whitney. She has had a 30-year career at Pratt and was one of the speakers.
I'm really pleased to be speaking with Marianne Cannon, who is the Pratt & Whitney Vice President of, Commercial Vice President now, correct?
Yep, Commercial Programs.
Commercial Programs. So tell us a little bit about the scope of your responsibility right now. Which commercial programs?
Excellent. So currently I have responsibility for the PW4000, PW2000, the JT80, JT90, and the PW6000 programs for Pratt & Whitney.
Okay, kind of the legacy sorts of programs.
Exactly. Lots of engines is still in service, 25, 30, 35 years, but they continue to fly and our customers continue to love them.
Sure, of course. You started out before Pratt & Whitney, where? You were at Grumman, were you?
Right. So when I got out of school, I have a mechanical engineering degree, and when I got out of school, I went to work for Grumman Aerospace in Calverton, Long Island, worked in flight test programs there, A6 program. We were actually re-engineering the A6 at the time, and then I was there for 3 years, and then I came to Pratt & Whitney. It was 30 years ago this year.
Wow.
Yeah, hired into the West Palm Beach plant.
Okay. Military?
Military, right. Mm-hmm. Working at the time, we were developing the engine, which would eventually become the F-119 and the F-22. So at the time, it was the PW5000, they called it at that time.
Oh, right.
And
well, that goes back.
Yeah, it does, right? So this was like 1989, and lived through the flight test program for that when we had the YF-22 versus the YF-23, and then Pratt & Whitney was selected to power the F-22. So started out in doing test engineer on the F-119, and then I've had a great 30 years, right? Lots of different roles, operations, quality, EH&S, engineering, and now, managing these fleets for Pratt & Whitney.
I think when I first knew you was when you were in quality, I think.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. Right. So I was vice president of quality and EH&S for Pratt & Whitney from 2011 to 2016. and had that role and really enjoyed that role. You know, I always look at quality as the voice of the customer inside the company, and enjoyed that. And now I have the direct interaction with the customer, and I'm enjoying that part of it as well.
Yeah, getting close to the customer is very rewarding. I mean, it can be very frustrating. It can be a lot of work. It can be difficult at times, but in the end, I think it's so rewarding to be that close to the people who are actually using the product.
Absolutely. You know, it's we don't exist if we don't have airlines that fly with our engines. And I really enjoy that customer interaction. And, whether it's easy or tough at times, I do enjoy that. I enjoy, representing the company in those conversations. And, you know, truly, I am passionate about the product that we have. And I love working on all the engines that we've had. And I've had the opportunity to work on so many and having the visibility to see how it actually is used in service is really exciting. Yeah,
wonderful, wonderful. Now, you're speaking here today, aren't you? What's the topic of your talk?
Sure. So today at the New England Air Museum, they have this program called Women Take Flight. And I'll talk today about the role that women have played at Pratt & Whitney from the beginning, since 1925, through the years, but then also the role that women have taken in aviation along the way, and some of the firsts, right? Some of, the Amelia Earharts and, some of the firsts that women have done, some of the first fighter pilots and the first, we'll talk about the first F-35. You know, that's our latest aircraft that we're on with the F-135 engine. So really the role that women have played at the company, but also the role that women have played in aviation in general. So I'm excited to talk about that. I think aviation is a field that has been open to women since day one. You know, since day one, women have played a role since the very beginning. Women have been there flying the product, using the product, and making the product. So I'm excited to talk about that and share it with this next generation and hopefully get them excited to come into the aerospace field.
I always thought it was interesting to learn about the situation at Boeing, where in the very early days they hired a lot of women because the aircraft were fabric covered. And so a lot of the production people that were sewing the fabric were women, and that how that kind of set the stage and contributed to a history in Boeing anyway, where there tended to be a good number of women involved. But other companies, not so much. I remember in the 70s when I first came to Pratt, there were not too many women in all organizations, but I really saw a specific focus on diversity and bringing women and other in minority groups as well into the company. It seemed to make a lot of progress. But I'm really encouraged by the number of young kids here today. There really are a lot of kids here today, so I think you're going to have an opportunity to touch a lot of people.
Yeah, it's amazing. Already I see hundreds of young girls and young men here today. And I agree, the Boeing history, Pratt mirrors it to a degree, certainly during the war years, when all the men were off fighting on the various fronts. Pratt & Whitney was hiring hundreds and hundreds of women to really build the jet engines, or not jet engines, but the radial engines at the time. It wasn't jet engines at the time, but the radial engines. So women came into the company, in huge numbers in the 40s. I think the role women play in the engineering side of the house, has picked up over the last, 20 years or so. And I know, Pratt & Whitney and UTC are really, dedicated to diversity and inclusion and, really bringing in women into roles across the organization. So that's exciting for me to see, as I've been there for 30 years and the number of women just continues to increase. And that's exciting.
It is. It's very important for many, many different reasons. You can look at it from just a competitive standpoint and having different perspectives in a company makes you a better company, makes you stronger. And I think it's just wonderful. So I'll be sitting probably in the back of the room. I'll let the kids sit up front when you're talking.
I know. I tell you, I don't get intimidated a lot, but little kids are going to intimidate me a little bit. But I'm excited about it. I hope they get excited about it. We have some cool videos to share with them, which I always think anytime you can see our product in action is pretty awesome. And and we have a video on how a jet engine works, and I think sometimes people don't really understand how it works, so we have a nice video to share with them as well, and then an awesome video that really talks about the people of Pratt & Whitney, because I think at the heart of it, it's about the people that make the product and the people that make it all come to fruition. So I'm excited to share that with the kids today.
Perfect. It's going to be a wonderful session, I'm sure. Thank you, Marianne Cannon.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
The 99s were at the event in full force. We spoke with Glenna Blackwell and Lori Plord. Glenna tells a great story about how she came to get her pilot's license.
One of the groups here at the New England Air Museum is the 99s, and they've got a big crowd of ladies here, and we're here to talk with several of them. First of all, we have
Lori Plord,
and also
Glenna Blackwell.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about the 99s. I think most of you listening are familiar generally with the 99s, but just to make sure everybody is up to the same level, maybe you can explain a little bit about the organization overall.
Sure, I'd be glad to. The 99s actually are celebrating our 90th birthday this coming year, 2019. Amelia Earhart was our first president. She gathered women together in 1929 and wanted to get a group formed, an organization formed, to just keep women inspiring each other. As you know, as most of you know, women only make up 6% of the total population of pilots.
Yeah, very small.
Very small. So this international organization was formed. And we have over 5,000 members currently from 35 different countries. What we do here in Connecticut is we have a chapter. The organization is about divided up into sections and then chapters. That way we can all get together. We all have the same mission. We like to introduce other girls to aviation, encourage them to fly, answer any questions, support. We have a wonderful scholarship opportunity. And in Connecticut, we have many women that fly maybe a 777 for American Airlines to airport managers, we have private pilots, we have, we actually have a balloonist that lives in Farmington,
really?
Yes.
Oh, I see the balloons. They fly over my house all the time.
Oh, wow, that's very cool. So we're just a diverse group, and we do many functions, fundraisers for our scholarship, for instance. We try to introduce other girls and women to flying. We certainly like to tell our story, to let people know about the 99s. Seems to be a secret. Let's see. We meet kind of monthly. We do flyouts. We have we take minutes. We're like a real organization. And I personally find it very inspiring and beneficial. Helps with my own pilot career, and I think, did I forget anything, Lori? Lori actually is here from Maine today to help out at this organization. We're here at the New England Air Museum. It's a yearly event called Women Take Flight, and it's just wonderful. Women from all aspects of aviation, not just pilots. There's actually engineers and mechanics and all sorts of aviation. It's interactive. I think there were like 600 Girl Scouts signed up to come through today. Plus, it's open for any family or boys and girls and men and
of course, yes,
women.
Yes.
So it's great fun.
So tell us a little bit about the table you have here and what you're doing with the kids today.
Yeah, so we offer the hands-on. We've got some worksheets, some parts of the airplane, some word searches, which kids love to do still. Right on down, we have the aircraft manufacturing with paper and stickers. And, who doesn't love stickers? So, we just want to give them a nice hands-on experience and kind of imprint our influence on them and let the girls know that they can fly, because when I was their age, I wasn't encouraged, even though it was something I really wanted to do, but there was so much mystique, and it was so mysterious, and only men did it, and you had to be in the military, and you couldn't wear glasses, and, you know, there was all these stipulations, but nobody knew. Nobody, you know, so we want to be here to, you know, dispel all that. If they want to fly, they think that sounds really cool, then they can go for it, and the 99s will help them along the way, because it's, you know, it's not easy. It's some commitment, you know. It's not hard. You have to know math. You don't have to be good at math. That was the other stipulation, good at math, which wasn't. Right. And so much, right, so much so I was so bad at math that I went to art school instead. But artists, Glennon and I, are both graphic designers, and we appreciate what we can see from above. We get that perspective. We have another woman who is now our section governor. She is an aerial photographer. She publishes books of her aerial, you know, designs. What you see in the air becomes more than just flying over a marsh. It becomes a beautiful design. So you know, as well as all the other aspects of aviation, behind the scenes, mechanics and engineers, and who, you know, I believe we've got maybe one or two. I'm not sure. Well, I know.
And glider pilots. We have a glider pilot here today. She actually is not a pilot, just gliders at this time in her life. We're trying to encourage her to do the add-on. But Lori touched on it, and it's just the beauty. The beauty from, you know, 3,000 feet, for instance.
There's nothing like it. Nothing like it.
And you see you have a different perspective on life. You see a little bit bigger picture, and it's just all seasons. It's just special. I always felt that everyone should have the opportunity to fly in a small aircraft, whether that's all you do, or, you know, get inspired to go for your license. But everyone should experience it, because it is a different viewpoint.
So you're a pilot yourself?
I am, yes.
The recreational or commercial? Or
recreational. I've always wanted to fly my entire life. My grandparents lived across the street from a small little airport in Great Barrington, Massachusetts.
Oh, yes, I know.
And I would go over there and just hang out all day long, and had a love for flying. And, of course, I never pursued it. I had two children, and when my son was 19, he expressed interest in flying. So I bought him a kind of a introduction flight. They call it an intro flight. And he went off backpacking for 3 months. So I thought, geez, I better use that certificate. And that was it. Honestly, I was hooked.
So you used his certificate?
Yeah. And
because he disappeared for 3 months, so mom took it and what?
And I was hooked. I could honestly, I knew what it was like to be addicted. I told my kids, I know what it's like to be addicted, because if I wasn't flying, I like wanted to be flying. There's so much. It opens a door to so many other opportunities. Like, I love the history of flying, particularly women in flight. And there's so much to read and so much to learn. And I love going to small airports. It's like a wealth of information, talking to the other pilots and the hangar talk. Hangar talk is really fun. And you hear people's stories, maybe how they became interested in flight. And, you know, I regret I didn't learn to fly. My father was military, a Marine. He wanted me to fly in the Marines back. I'm 64 now, and women were not accepted in the military very easily back then.
Right,
so,
of course,
you know, I just encourage people, because a lot of people I know said, I always wanted to learn to fly, but the time will never be right unless you make it right, you know. All of a sudden, time goes by, and you just have to do it. Nike commercial slogan, just do it.
My friends tell me the same thing, because I'm not a pilot, but I'm the same age as you. No. And my friends, they keep telling me, it's not too late, it's not too late. So what are you flying these days?
Oh, I fly a Cessna Cardinal. It's an RG, retractable gear. I've got my instrument rating and use it for that. My friend has a 1947 Piper Super Cruiser. It's cloth-covered tail dragger that I absolutely love. That's a kind of slow, and tooling around is great fun. We live in a beautiful place up here in the Northeast, you know, going out to the islands, the Martha's Vineyard or the Block Island, and in an airplane saves hours. It's just so easy to get around. Many of our members of the 99s have their own airplanes. That's on my wish list. Unfortunately, I don't own my own just yet. But another fallacy is people think it's just totally outrageous with cost. And, you know, I just want to tell them, compare it to a college semester. My son's college semester years ago was $32,000 for one semester. And he got nothing, you know, by going to school for 1 year, you get nothing. You don't get a degree. I got my pilot's license for $12,000 15 years ago. And you're always a pilot for the rest of your life. It is not a lot of money. And to rent airplanes and share with other pilots, so affordable.
Are you part of a flying club?
No. Unfortunately, the airport I fly out of, Great Barrington Airport, does not allow flying clubs. They've never... it was a private-owned airport, and he was a Piper dealer, so he didn't want people sharing, you know. But I have a lot of friends that own airplanes. I have a lot of opportunity to fly. Certainly, it's on my wish list when I win the lottery or whatever, but airplanes are not cost prohibitive. They are an old airplane with a new engine. Lasts forever.
Right,
so,
right. And just finally, how about you? What's your interest in aviation? Or do you just like hanging out with these guys?
I love hanging out. It's a great family. It's a great aviation family. The 99s are, I call them my sisters, my winged sisters. So it's been a great support system. It is.
Yeah. No, I know. Yeah.
So that's been great. Just always wanted that perspective. Want to get up there. Want to do it. So I did it. I was in my 30s, so it was about 20 years ago, and I said, "Yeah, I'm going to do it." Found the 99s, so that was great because I got now a network of other people, other women to fly with and visit and travel around New England, and you know, always have some place to go. It was a challenge. I mean, it's. With some dedication and simple math, you know, it's doable, but you do learn a lot, you know, as far as aerodynamics, you know, the whole nine yards. So that's exciting to be learning something new and, you know, and then just practice and push yourself to be good at it.
Great.
So it's a challenge and like that.
All right. Well, finally, just to close it out, why don't you tell our listeners where they can learn more about the 99s online and even the Connecticut chapter specifically?
Okay. Well, we have an international website that is very friendly and helpful. It's a wealth of information. The address is, of course, www.90-nines.org. There you'll find lots of information about the early years, our history, how to become a member. That it kind of breaks up the whole country into sections and chapters, so you know where you fall. The Connecticut chapter and the New England section actually has their own website. It's womenpilotsnewengland.org.
Okay.
And we'd love to have any of your listeners call or email and receive more information. We'd love to meet them. We set up this table and booth and at all the fly-ins throughout the summer months. Mm-hmm. You know, the locally Meriden Airport has a fly-in yearly, Simsbury Airport, Great Barrington Airport. So we try to get out there and inform the public about our organization. We're very dedicated. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you both very much, and have a great day.
Oh, thanks. So,
Glenna said womenpilotsnewengland.org, but the website for the Connecticut chapter of the 99s is actually womenpilotsct.org. CT, of course, being for Connecticut. An understandable goof when you have a microphone thrust into your face. Another lecture was presented by former Air Force pilot Christy Fleischman, now with Acrojet, providing in-aircraft training for professional and high-performance aircraft pilots. But Acrojet is actively trying to address the pilot shortage by creating and presenting STEM in aviation programs for students at the middle and high school level.
One of the speakers at today's event was Christy Fleischman, and she's with Acrojet. And we're here now with her at the Acrojet table. Christy, thanks for talking to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
I'm happy to. Thanks for asking.
Now, tell us a little bit about Acrojet. It's kind of an interesting company. It's not a big company, but tell me about some of the things that you do.
So Acrojet is an aerospace solutions company. We do training, in aircraft training for professional pilots and pilots of high-performing aircraft. We do upset training, unusual attitude training. We also do advanced training. If someone, for example, buys an airplane like ours, we will do their initial training, get them checked out. We also do formation training, and I guess that's it as far as flight goes. We are moving into an area that is more focused on supporting the aviation or the aerospace industry with different types of airplanes, be it being a chase aircraft or flying test equipment, or now there's actually a really big need. The military is outsourcing a lot of their training, so we're moving into that space as well. On the non-flying side of the house, we are very engaged in helping to solve the pilot shortage. And we're doing that by doing a fair amount of market research, working with the industry to do that, and also creating and presenting after-school and summer camp programs for middle schoolers and high schoolers that are focused on STEM and aviation. And now we have moved into, we work with a company called Milestone C, and we're building full year and two-year curriculums for high schools.
Interesting. So today's event is a good fit for that part of your business.
It absolutely is. Yep. Yeah. And it's really great to see everybody here who's so committed to general aviation and professional aviation and getting more women and minorities involved.
So when you spoke earlier today, what was the main message that you wanted, especially, I guess, the kids in the audience to leave with?
My main message is pretty simple. We need more pilots. But what we, I think, fail to recognize is that if we don't introduce potential pilots, particularly the ones that are underrepresented in the pilot ranks today, so women and minorities, there are several studies, particularly one, and I can talk about that later, but that suggests that if young people aren't introduced to the possibility of a certain career, it becomes almost an unintentional bias against that career. So the solution to that is we've got to get out there with aviation education and information at least by middle school. And there's also a fundamental misunderstanding or lack of understanding of what a professional pilot career is. And so not only do they not get that potential career field reinforced when they're young, they're not getting it from teachers, they're not getting it from parents, they're not getting it from career counselors. There's just no information out there. So our goal is to create an overarching marketing program, marketing campaign, if you will, to get the word out, you know, why I fly. You know, get them educated, get them accustomed or introduced to the potential of an aviation career.
So when you mentioned the students, teachers and parents who may not themselves be aware of aviation career or just the whole topic of aviation. So how do you reach the children?
I think the way that you reach the children, I think it's twofold. With in school or after school programs that focus on STEM and aviation, but I think also social media, TV, movies. I would love to see the Air Force come out with a Top Gun, you know, the Navy
killed it with that. And I know that Captain Marvel's out, and they're really capitalizing on that, but that wasn't their movie. So I think that there's a lot, there's nothing cooler than being a military pilot. That's easy. That's a home run. So anyway, I think we've got to get in front of them with the idea, be it in the classroom or on their screens.
So is this something that you have available now? You talked about a kind of a campaign, a package. Is it something that's being worked on now, or is it something that's ready to deliver?
Yes and no. So the classroom material is absolutely ready to deliver, and it's actually being implemented in several schools here in the Northeast, middle schools and high schools. And we're talking with some community colleges as well. And that's actually another subject that I would love to talk about. But as far as the marketing campaign, we have developed the research project. It starts with research, where we survey and interview the current population of airline pilots to understand what makes them tick. How do they get meaning out of their career, or do they get it at home? What kind of things do they enjoy doing when they're not working? How do they get their information? Did they study? What did they study in high school? What did they study in college? What did they play sports? You know, all of that to kind of create a persona that then we can reverse engineer into who these kids are now, and then we can reach them, better reach them with targeted messaging.
That's kind of fascinating because I can imagine it would be easy to start off with the proposition that I'm passionate about aviation. Here's what I like about it. You know, write it all down or package it all up and give it to, or present it to students or make it available to students. And it sounds like what you're doing is a little more detailed than that. That you're studying the motivations. You're looking at what the effect is you're trying to accomplish, and then designing something around that delivers it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's data-driven. Yes, it's a data-driven solution rather than a shotgun blast, which is kind of what's happening now. And it seems to me what's going on, particularly in military recruiting, is that they're just sort of piggybacking on the events that are already out there rather than really figuring out who their market is and then going after them with appropriate messaging. So I think we need to make it less emotional and reactive and more intentional and data driven.
Yeah, that is very interesting. And that's something that we've had on the show a couple of conversations about, how when you're trying to make young folks aware of something or to educate them or just present some information, we need to be thinking not in terms of how we received information successfully in the past when we were that age, but how do youngsters currently that age, how do they receive that?
Absolutely. And, you know, every generation is different. Every generation has different influences and different modes of communication available to them. And I think that we really need to understand that and capitalize on it. But, somebody asked me a while ago during the presentation, actually, right now, believe it or not, just over 5% of the commercial pilots in the United States are women. Right. Women make up 52% of the population in the U.S. And a guy that I was chatting with said, well, I just don't think that you're ever going to get equal representation. And my point is not that we need equal representation. We just need more than 5%. Right. That's ridiculous. Yeah. We can't afford to ignore that potential pool of aviators.
Now, you have, of course, a flying background yourself with the Air Force.
That's right. Yep. I graduated from an ROTC program at the University of Iowa, and I flew in the Air Force for 8 years active duty and then a couple years in the reserves. I flew C-141s during Desert Storm, and then I flew T-38s as an instructor for about 8 years after that.
So how does that experience, or how did that experience or those experiences sort of inform what you're doing now, what we've just been talking about?
Well, that's a good question. I can say that when I was doing those kinds of things, it was a long time ago, and although I was not in any way a trailblazer, it was still pretty early on as far as women being pilots, particularly in the military. And It was tough. It was a challenge. It was something that you had to set your sights on and then walk over, around, or through every barrier that people threw up, because they do. And so that was what was great about that is I learned that, you know what, no doesn't really mean no. It means I don't know how to help you. And I don't know how to help you is something that you can solve. That's a problem you can solve. No is a different story. So I think where we are now and how it relates to that is that we have a whole generation that isn't being told no. They're just not being told anything. So I think if they were given the opportunity, a lot of them would respond.
Are you still flying yourself?
I am. Yep, I fly. We have an L-39 that we fly down at Sikorsky Field in Stratford. And we are actively pursuing other aircraft, so I'm sure I'll be flying those too.
When we were talking before about the training that the AcroJet is offering, that's primarily to military customers?
It's really primarily to professional pilots and, people who are pretty experienced that want to get a little more specific training in upset recovery. And then the other part is really a service that we're providing.
And do you do that in the company jet or in the customer's aircraft as well?
We actually do both. Yeah.
And how long has AcroJet been in operation?
Well, that's a good question. Officially, I believe we've been around for 5 years. Yeah, but we just have started moving into this whole new education and recruitment, kind of get the word out, solve the problem kind of phase, which is a lot of fun.
Is that part of a business model or just something that you want to do?
Well, I think yes to both of those. You know, our ultimate goal is for AcroJet to be an aviation lifestyle company. So in that regard, you know, it would cater to people who were passionate about airplanes. So that's the kind of marketing side of but as far as the actual flying part, that we're moving toward working more with corporations and government agencies and that kind of thing.
Right. So you're obviously a pilot with a company with some experience. Are you the only pilot? Are there other pilots involved as well?
Absolutely not. No, I'm not the only pilot. My husband also flies with us, and then we have a business partner who flies as well. But, you know, as we go forward, we will definitely be looking to join forces with other like-minded aviators.
Yeah, great. So how can our audience learn more about AcroJet? Where can they go online? Webpage, probably?
You can go to our webpage, which is acrojet.net. Hope to have that updated with our new mission soon. But the best place to find the updated info is on Instagram. So it's AcroJet on Instagram. I'm not sure how that looks exactly, but it's easy to find.
All right. Thank you very much, Christy. Appreciate you taking a few minutes to talk to our audience.
You're very welcome. Anytime.
Now let's take a break from the museum floor and retreat to the quiet of a conference room for a conversation with Debbie Reed, the newly appointed executive director of the New England Air Museum.
Debbie Reed is executive director at the New England Air Museum. Debbie, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Well, thank you for having me. This is a pleasure.
Now, Debbie, are you new in this position as executive director?
I was appointed executive director last month. I've been here at the museum for 30 years. And when the previous director left last year, I was interim director. So I've just been appointed executive director.
And what are the responsibilities of the executive director when you come into work? What is that like? This is a full-time job or is this part-time?
It's a full-time position, and every day is different here, and that's what I like about it. You never know who's going to come through the door, who's going to be around to talk to. I guess my everyday job is just to oversee running of the museum, the daily operations of the museum.
How many employees does the museum have? I imagine there's some employees as well as a number of volunteers.
Yes. We do have 7 full-time staff. We have about 18 part-time employees and over 140 volunteers.
Wow. That's quite a collection. Are you always after more volunteers, or is there a good supply of people willing and able to help?
Well, it seems that when we have a need, they show up. Restoration is full of volunteers right now, but we could always use docents on the weekends. We need people around here. The busiest time for our visitors is on the weekend, so we could always use more people on the weekend to show the visitors around.
What makes a good docent at a museum like this?
A good docent. That's a good question. Somebody who's friendly, outgoing. You don't have to be knowledgeable about airplanes. It's something you're going to learn along the way. But have a good way with people, being able to interact with them, being able to realize that you've bored them or that they're interested in wanting to learn more.
And what makes a good executive director? What qualities are good for that position?
I don't know. You'd have to ask my staff and see what they think at this point. I think being understanding with the people around you. You hire people to do their jobs. If you let them do their jobs and guide them along the way, I think that makes a good executive director. So ask me in a year. We'll see what happens.
Yes, of course. The museum, the New England Air Museum, I think has kind of grown and expanded and improved over the years. If you haven't been here in a while and you come and visit the museum, there are a lot of new things and different things that are available to you.
I came to the museum as a part-time employee in 1989. So since I've been here, we built the military hangar, restoration facility, two storage hangars, and the B-29 hangar. So this museum is full of a lot of history and a lot of collection that we're very proud of.
What are the restoration projects that are currently underway?
All right, let's see. Restoration, we are restoring a Bernelli. It's a wide-body airplane that was built in Canada. It's one of a kind. I don't know where we're going to put it because the wingspan is incredibly long. We are in the process of pulling out the A-10 Warthog that we've had on display here, taking it off display, but we're going to bring it out, we're going to repaint it, and put it on display this summer. A lot of people keep asking about the A-10. It actually flew here at the Connecticut Air National Guard Base and flew in Desert Storm. So we're kind of looking forward to bringing that out. And the other and we have a small helicopter, an HOK, is being restored, cleaned up and restored to put back on display.
Now, are these aircraft that you'd had for a while, other than the A-10, are these aircraft you'd had for a while, or were these just acquired?
The Bernelli has always been here as long as I've been here. It was donated to the museum in the 80s, and it just basically sat out in the yard and started to deteriorate. And so we made the decision to bring it in and restore it because it is one of a kind. And a lot of the aircraft we have had in our collection, we take things off, they go in storage, and it's time to bring them out and clean them up.
Great, great. Now, as I pulled into the parking lot, I noticed that there were a couple of school buses here, and inside there is a big crowd of children. What are they doing, and what are some of the other events that are kind of focused at our younger folks?
We have a program called Soar for Science, where actually corporations and companies will sponsor a specific town or a school to come to the museum, and the education department runs a SOAR program, which is part of the STEM for their curriculum for fourth graders and eighth grade classes.
I think one of the features of this museum is that there are a wide variety of events throughout the course of the year. I think you seem to be very focused on doing a lot of that. Maybe tell us a little bit about some of the upcoming events that we can expect to find here at the museum.
What we seem to find is people will come to a museum, not necessarily ours, but go to a museum if there's something a little more than just the museum. So we have been very successful through the years running our special events. Open Cockpit is one of our most popular events. We do that about 5 times a year. Space Expo, our annual Space Expo that is going to be happening on April 6th, we've been running that for at least 10-plus years. We have an astronaut, so we have breakfast with an astronaut. If you're interested about that, give us a call. We'd sign you up. There is a fee involved. But the Space Expo has grown into our largest event of the year. A lot of vendors that are here talking about space or space exploration. And so it's a wonderful event to come to. We began 3 years ago a speaker series. Our next speaker will be in May. Steve Bork, who wrote the book Beyond the Beach. He's a military historian, and he's going to come and talk about his recent book. We do homeschool day two times a year. During the summer, every week during the summer, we're going to have a special feature of what the week will be involved, whether it's helicopters or jet planes. So there's a lot of activities that we do throughout the year.
You know, we talk a lot about things like the pilot shortage and the shortage of others in the aviation industry, cabin attendants, but also others in the supporting functions for aviation. And in those conversations, we always talk about STEM and being able to, or rather the importance of getting young people sort of into the pipeline for aviation. And when I come here, I really feel like that's a strong focus area for you.
It is. We have a program called Inspiring Future Aviators, and it's been supported by Bombardier. And what that means is we go after the tech school, we bring them to the museum, give them a tour, and then they go to Bombardier Aerospace and learn that there's more to do besides being a pilot. You need mechanics. You need people in finance. So this gives these high school students just a little bit of taste of what is out there in the aviation field, and it's been very successful. And our Soar for Science program, it's interesting because we do Soar for Science up in Westfield, Mass. Now, after they're done in fourth grade with the Soar for Science program, there's another organization up there called the Wright Flight who's actually taking students interested in aviation and putting them in giving them more of a background of aviation. Now, we've actually had students in the SOAR class who signed up for this Wright Flight class. So there is already somebody who's gotten the bug on aviation futures.
Are there other focus areas for this year? I mean, that sounds like an awful lot just right there. Are there some other focus areas for this year or maybe farther into the future for the museum?
I think definitely in the future. We've got we've talked about our education programs, which Amanda Goodhart Parks has done an excellent job with reaching out to many of the schools, providing them programs that they're requesting from us. But our capacity here, we don't have the right capacity to handle the amount of requests that we're getting. So we're looking at the future of the museum. We're looking at the possibility of building an education facility and making it an education technology center so we can do more SOAR classes, so we can do more STEM classes. And because the state of Connecticut is talking about the shortage of the field in aviation, whether it's mechanics, even in the aviation field in equipment and stuff like that. Pratt & Whitney's looking for more engineers. There's a lot of other companies, small manufacturing companies, that are looking for engineers. So we're trying to figure out how to go about providing those needs, bringing students here and making them aware of what's out there and the possibilities. It's not always going to be kids don't always need to go to college. There's a lot of technical jobs out there that we have a shortage of. So we need to make these students aware that there are other opportunities besides going to college and spending a lot of money for your future and then not finding a job in that future.
It sounds like the museum has a good relationship not only with maybe the state of Connecticut, but also with the aviation or aerospace companies that are in the state.
Yeah. Pratt & Whitney, UTC in general, has always been a good supporter of the museum. And I think now we're beginning to realize that there's a lot of other things that we can be doing. We are very active with the aerospace manufacturing companies, and we do events here for them. And we're trying to work with them, maybe do a job fair next fall or something, and start reaching out to these students. A lot of these companies also have intern programs. So if we can do a job fair and then connect some interns to some of these companies, it's a win-win for all of us. It's getting people to the museum, letting them see our collection, but then introducing them to companies for their future.
Very good. Let's just touch for a second on funding. I mean, it must take quite a bit of money to operate all of this. It's a charitable organization?
Nonprofit, yes. We are, yeah.
Well, tell us a little bit about the funding and where the money comes from. And we've been talking about how it's been used, but where does it come from?
Well, we get money from admissions, gift shop sales. That's why special events, we get good attendance there. But a lot of our funding comes from private companies, corporations. We have a development director that goes after funding for us. We have a membership, and believe it or not, our fund drive with the membership is a very good turnaround. And just support comes in a lot of different ways. We have gotten funding from the state in the past, some bond money to build some of our buildings and do some of the projects here, which we're grateful for that. But a lot of money does come from corporations and foundations and grants.
Mm-hmm. I became a member finally last year. I'm embarrassed to say that it took so long for me to do that. I have no real excuse. One final thing. I'm curious because you mentioned that you've been here for many years, originally as a volunteer. What drew you to the museum originally?
I came to the museum in 1989 as a part-time cashier and just never left. And I think my biggest joy here is getting to know the volunteers that we've had through the years, some incredible people that I've worked with through the years that have taught me a lot about aviation and the history. And I'm just really proud to be here.
It's kind of like an infection in some ways, or catching a bug. Once you get it, and I think it's fascinating that you came in as a cashier and you caught the bug.
It is. But again, I think it's the people around you. You know, that's why hopefully I'll be a good director. It's the people around you that make it worth coming every day. And every day is a different day. You just never know what's going to happen. And just walking out there and chatting with the volunteers and asking them to do things, it just makes it all worthwhile.
Very good. Debbie Reed, thanks so much. Tell us again where people can learn more about the museum online.
You can follow us on Facebook, NEEM.org, or our website, www.neem.org, and all our information is there.
All right. Debbie Reed, Executive Director at the New England Air Museum.
Back on the floor, another table in the museum was staffed by women from the University of Connecticut Department of Mechanical Engineering. We spoke with them about composites in aviation.
I found a table here that drew me in for two different reasons. One is UConn, and because this is Connecticut, I'm interested in UConn. But I also saw, like, composites on the table here. And we're here with a number of folks. And what's your name?
Alexis Coppola.
And tell me about this UConn lab that you're involved in.
Well, I'm not really involved with the lab. She's actually my professor. She's my composites teacher.
She's your composites teacher.
She is.
We're going to get her on the mic in just a second.
Oh,
she doesn't. She tried to resist, but
no, I'm not.
Okay, all right. So composites. You're in an engineering program.
Yep, I'm in mechanical engineering. I'm a senior.
And so, tell me about the composites area. Is that something that was just like completely fascinating to you, or?
Yeah, actually, I was an intern at Sikorsky in blades design. And one of the things about the blades designers is they hire a lot of engineers with no composite experience because it's so new. There's not a lot of schooling on it. There's not a lot of classes for it. But I got lucky. It's my last semester, so I'm going to graduate soon. And it just so happened that they were letting undergraduates take this course. So I wanted to learn more about composites than just what you see, right? More about the math and the technical aspect of it.
So I'll talk about that a little bit. I mean, I think, our audience is generally knowledgeable about composites on a basic level, the components of it, the curing process, all of that kind of thing. And of course, we're starting to see, and have been seeing more and more composites in aircraft. So tell us a little bit about the course and the what you've learned about composites. Yeah, this is the final exam. We didn't tell you that.
Don't listen. So I've taken other classes where we learn about more traditional materials that are used on aircraft. And one of the huge differences about composites is that it's an isotropic material instead of an isotropic material. So in terms of the microstructure and the strength properties and the different moduli, they're very different from traditional aircraft material. And now we're starting to kind of dive deep onto what that means and how to, how to use that maybe in more design or manufacturing and things like that.
When we look at composite structures in aircraft, are there different kinds of composites that are important, or is it all just sort of, you know, carbon fiber composites and it's pretty much the same across different applications?
No, actually, it depends on the application, but there's tons of different kinds of composites, and it depends on what you're trying to make. So with blades, because that's kind of where my background is a blade is made out of a lot of different kinds of composites. And actually, there's honeycomb in there. There's foam in some blades. It's not just the carbon fiber and epoxy combination that most people they think to. You know, the skin of the blade is not made out of carbon fiber. It's actually made out of graphite usually, or fiberglass. I'm sorry, fiberglass. So there's a lot of different and all these combinations of composites come together and make the final blade. So it's kind of interesting to see it all.
So the different types of composites must have different types of properties, right? And that's why you use a mixture of different types?
Exactly. And some are better than others, but it depends on the application again.
So what are the kinds of properties that are, you know, important when we're talking about this kind of thing?
For composites, usually you're looking for strength. But there are some applications where you don't really need strength, right? You don't need to worry about that. And maybe something else is cheaper or might mold better and things like that you have to consider.
So you said you're a senior this year?
I'm a senior.
So do you have plans for what comes next?
Well, I'm actually in the military, too. So after I graduate, I'm going to be on a deployment. And then after that, I'll focus on my first engineering job and what.
What branch of the military?
Air Force Guard.
Yeah?
Right around the corner.
Yes, yeah, right here at the at the airport here.
C-130s, no composites yet. Not in the old models.
So what are you doing with the Guard? Are you flying?
No, not yet. I'm a mechanic. I need a degree first before I can fly. Okay. That's how it works. So this is my degree.
But you want to fly eventually?
I do want to fly. Even if it's just recreational, I want to fly for sure.
Yeah. So one of the co-hosts on this podcast, his name's David Vanderhoof, and the C-130 is one of his favorite airplanes.
Me too.
Yeah, so if you were going to send a message to David about the C-130 and how much you love it, what would you say?
Well, I'd say, first, they're still flying. We have 70 models, actually, in Connecticut, and they're still flying. They're great airplanes. They're workhorses. They're really reliable, and it's part of the reason why I fell in love with aerospace. So very, very glad to have it had experience on those planes.
Terrific. Wonderful. So let's talk about the lab just a little bit. What is the lab all about?
Sure. So what we are mainly doing research at the lab, and we are trying do the manufacturing process, but we also have a computational model that can help us to better understand the process and the performance. So we are mainly doing virtual simulation of the manufacturing process and try to link the process and effects into the performance prediction.
So, you know, one thing that we talk about sometimes, and it's kind of interesting to me, is on the maintenance side. You know, when you have a component that's damaged and all. And I know that was one of the conversations when we started to see more and more composites in airframes was, you know, with aluminum, there's a long history of how you repair it. So when we look at composites and the need to repair them, Is this something that's well understood or something that we need to really study more?
I think this is a good question. I don't think we now have a conclusive conclusion on how to do the best repair. We usually combine with the bolts and also the adhesive to try to get a durability, make sure the durability of the repaired part. I think this is really an area that we need more research, and it's also the time we need to bring computational model to better understand the failure behavior. That's so important, so critical. And I think one critical thing is also bringing the manufacturing process into the model. That is the area that we overlook in the past, is we assume that we just there's no defects in the component that we do the model, while what we are doing is to integrate the process and the defects. And this also carrying to the manufacturing process, the repair process, because the repair is also a manufacturing. So,
yes, oh, that's fascinating. So, How long has the lab been operating at UConn? Is this something new?
This is my fourth year, so I would say relatively new, but not that new. We have lots of synergy in compounded in Connecticut. So we closely work with Pratt Whitney and GKN doing compounded research and projects and also education. We have compounded certificate, which is really fascinating.
All right. Well, great. So this event here, why did you guys come to this event today?
Well, aerospace is always my passion. I want to do something to the local museum. And they feel this is the best event that we can show our participation, our passion, and help to educate young kids.
Oh, it's always about the kids, right? We need to start young. And there's certainly a lot of them around, although right now I think there's a presentation going on, which is why most of them are probably in the auditorium right now, but I'm sure they'll return shortly. So have a great day. Thanks for talking with you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The third special speaker was Shasta Ways, who flew around the world solo in a Beechcraft Bonanza. Shasta has an interesting history and a strong drive to shape the future for girls and young women in aviation and STEM. She's the founder and president of Dream Soar.
Shasta Ways talked today to a group of children, youngsters and parents and others as well. And Shasta has a very interesting history in that she flew around the world in 2017 in a Beechcraft Bonanza. Shasta, why'd you do that? What was the motivation?
Well, I'd had a desire to connect with young kids around the world, to tell them that you can come from a different background. My background, I didn't grow up near airplanes. My parents are originally from Afghanistan. They came to the United States as refugees, and I always thought that those were challenges that I couldn't surpass in the aviation industry. And sure enough, as I progressed in aviation, I realized anything is possible, and that was a message that I wanted to share with kids around the world. And that's why I flew a Bonanza around the world, is to share that message with kids.
What kind of support did you get? Did your parents think that you were crazy? Did your friends wonder what you were up to? This is not an easy thing to do. It takes right. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of resources to pull off. How did you do that?
Luckily, I had a mother and father. So I have five sisters, six girls. My mother and father were very supportive in anything that I decided to do, educationally or career-wise. So that definitely helped. But I did have other members of my family who thought, aviation is not for women, and I don't belong in a cockpit, and I'm wasting my time. And at one point, I remember my grandma asking me, how are you going to get married? What type of man's going to want his wife to be away from home? So, I did get that feedback, but overall, you just have to stay strong, stay true to yourself, and go after the things that you believe in. And when you do that, other people will kind of align themselves and understand your dreams and your vision.
Tell us just really briefly kind of the route that you took and the kinds of people you met and what you did at those different stops.
Sure. So I started off in Daytona Beach, Florida. I took off and I went up north to Columbus, Ohio, then made my way up to Canada, crossed the Atlantic Ocean into Santa Maria, the Azores. From there, I had a couple stops in Europe. I went down to Cairo, which was my only stop in Africa, in Egypt. Then from there, I made my way through the Middle East, going to Dubai, Oman. I crossed the Indian Ocean into India, then went down to Sri Lanka. From there, went into Asia. I went to Thailand, Singapore, Indonesia, down Australia. Then I started to head back up north, flew over a series of South Pacific islands to Hawaii. And then from Hawaii, I flew the longest leg, which was about 14 and a half hours long, in the Bonanza, to California.
And you did more than just pick up fuel at each of these stops.
Correct. So the whole backbone of the global flight around the world was to inspire the next generation of STEM and aviation professionals. So at most of the stops, so there's a total of 30 stops, and we hosted 32 outreach events around the world where I got to connect with a group of children in most of the stops and talk to them about STEM and aviation, inspire them, and then kind of get back in the plane and move on to the next country.
When you did that, you didn't just land, look around, and see, are there any youngsters around? It sounds like these were planned events.
Correct. They were all planned, and one of our biggest outreach partner was ICAO, the International Civil Aviation Organization. They were really key, allowing us to work with all of the countries along the stops, and making sure we had an audience, that we were going to make an impact, that the government was involved. So a lot of logistics and planning went into these events, and I mean, it was the core of the trip. I don't think I would have had the strength to carry on and finish the trip if I didn't have this aspect where I could connect with kids.
Yeah, there was at one point in your talk earlier today, you mentioned some problem that you had with the communications antenna, mm-hmm. and that in some ways you almost started to question this adventure that you were just starting at that point, I guess. And you mentioned that it was that there were these youngsters who are waiting for you to come, and that motivated you to continue.
Yeah, I mean, I think anytime you embark on a dream or anything that's going to require a lot out of you, if you don't have a strong sense of purpose for doing it, it's so easy to give up. And in my case, one of my antennas for the HF radio sheared off the aircraft when I was about 300 miles into the Atlantic Ocean. And it was very scary. I didn't have any radio communications with air traffic control. I had to turn the plane around, land at an airport, only to be told that I need to fly to another airport. So all of that really just put a lot of, I wouldn't say fear, it was just like tiredness and just wanting to go home. And then that's when I reminded myself, I'm doing this to inspire others, so I have to be brave. And that allowed me to keep going forward.
And what kind of reaction did you get from the youngsters that you met along the way?
I mean, they were just so excited. And I mean, some of these kids that I had met had never met a female pilot before. They'd never seen an airplane up close. And so it was very, unreal for them. And their reactions made it that much more special to me, you know, to have been there. Yeah.
So what about your flying background? I mean, what made you, capable of undertaking a flight like this?
So I, when I first got into aviation, I went to Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Daytona Beach, Florida. That's where I got my bachelor's degree. I got my private and my instrument rating there. I stayed on for a master's degree. And then I did my commercial pilot's I received my commercial pilot license outside of Embry-Riddle, but I did all of the training in the Bonanza that I flew around the world. So all of that preparation was really key to getting me ready.
And you were not born into a rich family that could fund a flight around the world. I mean, your beginnings are kind of very interesting and really part of the story also.
Yeah, so I didn't grow up near an airport, didn't have any family in aviation, and my family certainly, as refugees, didn't have a lot of money. And my parents had to support six girls. So a lot of it was on me to figure it out, and I applied to several scholarships. I did run out of money several times, and at one point I started to get more involved at Embry-Riddle, and there was this big initiative to bring more women to the university. And I came up with this idea, which is now called the Women's Ambassadors Program. It's a program at Embry-Riddle that's focused on increasing the female enrollment and retention. But through an idea that I had, that I pitched it to the president at the time, it became a program and it's still in existence. And it was through the development of this program, Women's Ambassadors Program, that I was able to continue to fly. So I had to get creative in finding ways to make it in aviation. And I'm very grateful for the challenges because it's really made me value every second of flight training.
Now, you have a nonprofit, or there is a nonprofit. Tell us a little bit about what that is and what its objectives are.
So my nonprofit is called Dream Soar Incorporated. We're based out of Florida, and our mission is to inspire the next generation. And the first phase of that mission was to launch the Global Flight and to host these outreach events around the world.
Great, great. And what does the future look like for you?
Oh, boy. You know, whatever the future is going to take me, I just want to make sure it involves me flying and it involves me connecting with the next generation. It's something I truly enjoy doing. The possibilities are endless, and I'm just taking my time to figure out what that future can look like.
That's terrific. I'm sure it'll be very interesting, whatever it becomes, and I'm sure getting to know you a little bit, it's going to be something that really impacts the lives of others, and that's just wonderful. So thanks for talking with our audience.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Great.
Some of the kids behind us got a little rambunctious towards the end of that, but that's okay. They were having fun, and that's what the event was all about. Well, I hope you enjoyed our conversations at Women Take Flight at the New England Air Museum. The museum is located adjacent to Bradley International Airport in Windsor Locks, Connecticut. They're midway between Hartford, Connecticut and Springfield, Massachusetts. Their website is neam.org. That's New England Air Museum, neam.org. And there you'll find a list of the upcoming events. Let me mention that many of the people we meet at events and record an interview with have little or no experience in front of a microphone. It can be pretty intimidating for first-timers, and I want to thank all those who spoke to us at the Women Take Flight event. I'll also say, I heard comments from attendees about how really impressed they were by the museum and what they found there. That went for first-time visitors, and also for those who hadn't been back in several years. What I heard most was, gee, I have to come here more often. It's a great museum. And as for all the young girls who came, well, you could see in their faces that their eyes were opened to the possibilities that they had been unaware of before. It was a great event. My larger takeaways are these, in no particular order. Organizations can be very effective when they offer engaging activities. There are benefits to collaboration with industry and the local community. It's important to impress children at a young age that aviation is something where they can find opportunities. And while all that certainly applies to museums, it also applies to schools, flying clubs, and other aviation organizations. It even applies to us as individuals when we have the opportunity to leave a meaningful impression, particularly with young people. So, thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Find us at airplanegeeks.com. There you'll see show notes for this and every episode. Those include all the links you heard us mention, photos from the event, and more. The shortcut that redirects right to the show notes is airplanegeeks.com/546. You can email us at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And you can subscribe to this podcast through your favorite podcast app or on Stitcher, Spotify, TuneIn, and Pandora. Our outro is by Bruno Massone. You can find more of his compositions that incorporate aviation sounds at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Ladies and gentlemen, in a few moments, we shall...